Blog Talk Radio. Welcome to Movie Geeks United. Tonight, he's one of the most inspiring independent filmmakers of our time, writer and director John Sayles. Plus, the director of the new Disney family film Enchanted, Kevin Lemma. Then, the author of Fast, Cheap, and Written That Way, low-budget guru, John Gaspard. Now, dim the lights, grab the popcorn, and get ready to get your geek on. Here are your hosts for Movie Geeks United, Jamie, Chris, and Jerry.
Welcome, everybody, to another great episode of Movie Geeks United. It's a nice Sunday late afternoon evening when we're bringing this broadcast to you live. A nice day. Apparently, you have bad weather where you are, right, Jerry?
Yeah, the power could go out at any time. It's been flickering, and that definitely, they're trying to tamper with my way to get into the chat room. So, we'll see what happens.
That's the beauty of live radio. We could lose you at any moment.
That's right.
The tightrope that is live radio.
That's right.
For all of you that are not yet acclimated to our show, this is Movie Geeks United. It's a real. Anyone that has a real passion for movies, this is heaven for you, basically. And we are your co-hosts. My name is Jamie, and you just heard from Jerry as well. And Chris is off this evening, but he's another regular Movie Geeks host, and he will be back with us next Sunday.
We're always happy when he's on.
Yeah. So, man, great show tonight.
We have an awesome show.
I mean, what a lineup we have tonight. You can subscribe to our show through iTunes, and you'll automatically... It will automatically download all the archived shows and all the new shows as soon as they are archived for replay. It's absolutely free. We're on our 53rd show now. Great guests like film directors like Brian De Palma and just an amazing lineup
of
talent.
John Badham.
Character actors like Raymond J. Barry and Joe Pantoliano, famed film composers like Howard Shore and Mark Isham, and just on and on. Screenwriters who are nominated this season for all kinds of awards.
Yeah.
Kelly Masterson, the screenwriter of Before the Devil Knows You're Dead, one of the most buzzed about scripts of the year. A great lineup of shows. And you can get them absolutely free, downloaded directly to your iTunes service. You know, and we know people that play them on their iPod all the time.
Yeah, I know several people that play them on the iPod, to work, going running.
Yeah, we've had fan mail from people that have said, look, I take a commute every day. This one last fan letter we got, I take a commute every day, and on the train I'm listening to every one of your shows. I'm catching up.
No, it's great.
We're part of people's lives, Jerry.
Yes, we are.
That's powerful.
It's power.
But a great show for you tonight. We're awaiting the call from Mr. John Sayles to start off our show, and then we'll be welcoming Kevin Lemma, the director of Enchanted, which is one of the season's biggest hits, family films, just a delightful film, and John Gaspard, the author of Fast, Cheap, and Written That Way. It's a great, great, inspiring how-to book for the low-budget filmmaker. It's taken directly from Q&As with the great directors who have been there and done that, like John Sayles and Robert Rodriguez, and just a plethora of great talent represented
right.
in that book. Great insights, and there's something about Q&A books too that just you feel like you get more out of them somehow.
Well, I think this is this direct interaction between the questioner yeah. and obviously the subject. So a lot of those books are you get to no extraneous information. It's everything you want to know.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. So we're still awaiting Mr. Sayles' call. He should be calling in any moment now. But how's your weekend been? What kind of films have you checked out?
I saw Sweeney Todd and Charlie Wilson's War. Both films that I liked a lot.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know if I'd say that. I think I might put Sweeney Todd as definitely one of the best of the year. I'm not sure about Charlie Wilson's War, but I do have to say this about Charlie Wilson's War. As far as the politically themed movies,
yeah.
it's by far the best of the year. In that regard, they got some things right, and I think their approach to it, Sorkin and Nichols, was the right way to go. definitely the right way to go.
This seems like a real no-brainer project for me in terms of a film that I'll respond to. I have not yet seen it, but you're talking about Mike Nichols. He is the most vivid and relevant as he's ever been. I think of his work in Closer, and that does not seem like the work of a man nearing the end of his career. You know?
No, it does. Actually, Closer, I think, is a better film than this.
Right.
This is a very fluff piece. And I know that seems like an odd word to use, but it is fluff. I mean, it's very good fluff. But I think what it is that Aaron Sorkin and Mike Nichols, and especially Sorkin, he treats politics as pop culture.
Mm-hmm.
And he does it very well. You know, this isn't, they don't make the mistake that I think several other films have made that are like preachy, polemical films. This is just a, how should we say it, a nice flashback to the early 80s.
Right.
And a very different time that probably a lot of the younger people aren't used to, when it, a different political environment.
Hmm. Well, and it comes from my favorite writer, too, who's Aaron Sorkin.
Yeah.
And obviously one of the highlights of the film has to be the dialogue. And as much, you know, I'm definitely, I appreciate good character development, and but I'm a sucker for great dialogue.
And he has some of Hanks, Roberts, and especially Hoffman, who really steals the movie from everyone. Philip Seymour Hoffman steals this film from everyone. Whenever he's on screen, I mean, he's great.
And meanwhile, Sweeney Todd impressed you greatly.
Hey, Sweeney Todd's good. Here's the thing. I sort of knew Depp could sing, but now that I know he can sing, he's sort of unstoppable. But I was really impressed with Helena Bonham Carter.
Right.
I didn't know what to expect from her. And she was just as good, I thought. I mean, that really came out of nowhere. I did not expect that at all.
Yeah, they say that she really comes across in the film very well. And they say that what's also impressive about it, outside of, you can expect this kind of meticulous and elaborate art direction and the look to Burton's films. I mean, that's always been a strength of his.
Right.
That vision. But that it doesn't waver from going as far as it has to, you know, because it's a nasty, it's the bloodiest Broadway musical.
It is a bloody Broadway musical, very bloody. My thing is this, what I was really, you know, even though I knew Stephen Sondheim did the music and everything, it's quite a shock to hear watching the opening credits and not see Danny Elfman's name anywhere. You know, always used Danny Elfman. I was just like turning to my mom and I was like, wow, you know, I'm just not used to that. Even though I know it's based on all of his music and everything, you always associate Burton and Elfman, and he's not there.
Yeah.
And that, I knew that was coming, but it's just so weird not to see his name.
Because they are such frequent collaborators.
Yes. But
do you think with this material that he's kind of entered another zone? Because with Burton, there seems to be some hit-or-miss movies for me in terms of my emotional involvement.
Right. I think he's entered another realm. I think as far as adapted material, I mean, certainly this is light years ahead of the really the ill-fated remake of Planet of the Apes, obviously, which I was always surprised he went with that and what he did with that. I mean, his one truly bad film.
Uh-huh.
But here I was impressed. I'm just curious to see what he's going to do next, but I think this is a winning collaboration. Him and Johnny Depp, for the most part, work. I mean, I'm not a big fan of Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. I won't lie. I had mixed feelings about it. But, I mean, I liked it a little bit more than Planet of the Apes, but, you know, I like a lot of things more than the remake of Planet of the Apes. But I'll be very curious to see what he does after this.
Yeah. Yeah. He's a fascinating director.
Oh, he is.
Absolute visionary. We welcome everyone out there on the chat room. We are awaiting Mr. Sales call. I am just in the process of typing to the publicist
right
now. It was confirmed on Friday, or double confirmed. So we're going to get to the bottom of this. But we thank everyone out there for joining us on the chat room. The number to call into the show, if you have any questions for us or any of our guests, is 718-508-9477. so just feel free to do that. Halfway through this hour at 6:30 Eastern, we will be welcoming Kevin Lema, the director of Enchanted, which is a great audience-pleasing film. And then at the top of the next hour at 7 p.m. Eastern, John Gaspard, Fast, Cheap, and Written That Way, a great how-to book for the low-budget filmmaker.
Right.
Taken from the advice of people that have actually done it, which I think that's important.
Yeah, no, that's always important.
Yeah, you see so many of these books that are written, and they're written by people that have not actually had the experience to write a book. So it's always refreshing to see something that actually comes from the mouths of the insiders themselves.
No, I think that's very important, especially when you get it from a Kevin Smith or a Rodriguez or a Tarantino. It always helps to get their perspective, how they did it, because each of these filmmakers and many other filmmakers we haven't even mentioned, everyone took a different path. And it's always fascinating. Like Darren Aronofsky, when he made Pi, they went around the neighborhood to raise money for the movie. I mean, there's just lots of different avenues people take.
Yeah. I'm finishing typing. Go ahead. Keep talking, Jay.
Oh, keep talking. Okay. Yeah, so, I mean, I always like the Rebel Without a Crew by Rodriguez. They talk about, they do all the experiments. They donate all the blood, And all these stories is just to make their film.
Yeah.
They're always fascinating what people do, the lens to people do to get their film. And I think what's amazing is we're still talking about these people. They're still in the game because they're willing to go the extra lens. They would do whatever it takes to get their film made. And we still talk about them, each and every one of them. I'm curious, in that book, does he interview Whit Stillman?
There's the Metropolitan
in Barcelona.
Yeah, I believe so. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
He's a fascinating filmmaker. Sadly, he hasn't made anything since The Last Days of Disco, which was 1998. But I mean, like I was telling you about Alex Cox a couple weeks ago. There's another guy I'd love to have on the show. I would just love to hear. First of all, I just want to know what he's been up to for the last 9 years. But these are just fascinating people that are very, especially Whit Stillman, is very responsible in 1990 with Metropolitan. He's part of that whole wave of indie groundbreaking films like Henry, Portrait of a Serial Killer, Metropolitan. These are films that you heard about that summer on Hal Hartley's The Unbelievable Truth that were really redefining the American independent landscape.
Right, I agree. I'm going to take a chance here. I see that we have a call on the line. It's a call, and I did not confirm the area code that Mr. Sales would be calling from. So, in case this is Mr. Sales, I'm going to go ahead and read the intro.
Okay, this is a risk.
This is a risk. This is live radio, and hopefully we'll have a home run here. We're very excited tonight to welcome director John Sales to the show. He is a tremendous filmmaker whose stellar and versatile works include films like 8 Men Out, The Return of Secaucus 7, Baby It's You, The Brother from Another Planet, City of Hope, Passion Fish, and Silver City. Each of his films are elevated by his profoundly independent spirit and his refusal to compromise his vision to satisfy typical Hollywood conventions. Now, in his 16th gorgeously realized vision titled Honey Dripper, he tells the story of an aging juke joint owner in 1950s Alabama who has one last shot to save his beloved establishment and his fragile independence. Starring Danny Glover, Stacey Keach, and Charles Dutton, Honey Dripper is a fantastically entertaining and rich experience, possessing the keen understanding of character and place that mark all of Mr. Sales' astonishing work. It is a great pleasure to welcome Mr. John Sales to our program. Mr. Sales, is this you?
This is not. I hate to let you down. This is John Gaspard. I saw that there's nobody on yet. I thought I'd call in early and see if I could help fill some time until he did call.
That would be great.
Love to talk to you. I mean, better late, better early than not at all.
I was not at all last time, so I thought.
Well, that's all right. We understand that, but we're very happy to have you on the show.
Absolutely. What did you think of the intro, by the way?
I just feel so good about myself right now. I didn't know all that stuff. And it wasn't until you said the second name that I thought, oh, it's Sales, not Gaspard.
Well, I guess this is a terrific opportunity. We definitely have the interview segment all written out for you. But let's talk a little bit about Sales, because you did interview him.
I didn't. I did not. I culled in the first interview book I did, Fast, Cheap, and Written, Under Control.
Right.
I culled some interview stuff he'd already done in other places, and then I tried to get him for the second book, and he was completely unavailable and actually sort of unnervingly disappeared in the tsunami. I was talking to his, emailing back and forth with his representative, and he said, you know, the tsunami came and went, and John was over there, and I haven't heard from him.
Oh, wow.
So that was kind of weird. I don't know what happened there. But I never connected with him, although I did talk to Roger Corman about him, and he, you know, he's kind of the quintessential independent filmmaker. He's the one on which a lot of people have based what they do, just because he was so smart in Zukakis 7, and all the things he did, every step he took on that film was sort of a lesson in itself.
Right.
Excuse me, John.
Yes.
Would you say that he is this generation's or his generation's John Cassavetes, or at least the closest thing to a Cassavetes, or is that a bad analogy on my part?
Well, it really isn't fair to either one of them, because Cassavetes really never really found the commercial balance that Sales has, and kind of really fought to be outside the system, whereas Sales, I think, really wants audiences to get into and enjoy his movies, and I think Cassavetes wanted to push you away a little bit more with his stuff.
Right. You don't think that even when he was acting in the the commercial films...
Well, yeah, that analogy is true, and that's
That's what I was really going for.
Hollywood in order to finance his stuff in Cassavetes.
Yeah,
the same thing with the acting.
I'm sorry, I didn't make that clear. I'm sorry.
That's right. I'm fine.
It does seem like an odd kind of duality, though, that you exist on one realm, writing, scripting, doctoring scripts for the kinds of movies that you want to avoid making at all costs on your own.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't think he turns his nose up at those films.
No.
If you look at Piranha, it's a very funny movie.
Yeah.
I just don't think that's personally what he wants to make, and he's got the luxury of doing both, of, you know, doing writing that pays really well that doesn't have his name on it, and then doing the kind of stuff he wants.
Right. And his new film, Honey Drippers, it's fantastically entertaining. You know, you get the sense of, whenever you talk about a director that refuses to compromise and that sort of thing, the qualities that he embodies, that somehow can give off a wrong impression that he doesn't make completely involving, entertaining films, and very emotionally involving and fantastically entertaining.
Well, he's a really good dramatist.
Yes.
He's a very good storyteller.
Some of his films are very emotionally involving. The Lone Star, The Secret of Rowan Inish, Brother from Another Planet, Baby, It's You. Some of those are just, you know, you can't help. And City of Hope, the ensemble dramas, even Silver City, these are very emotionally involved dramas that you get caught up in.
And you know what's interesting is if you put all those movies side by side and showed them to someone who'd never seen them and took his name off of them, they wouldn't think they're made by the same filmmaker. But if you put the Cassavetes films next to each other,
if you showed that box set, definitely happen.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. There's such a versatility in the themes and the characters that he's interested in. I've read where he said that he wants to explore worlds that he doesn't know firsthand. When he sets off to write a project, it's not because he already knows it intimately. It's because he wants to know more about it.
Yeah.
And there's such a sense of kind of discovery and really a sense of community that exists in his films that you can't really find so vividly realized in others' work.
Oh, I think that's very true in the last couple of films. I haven't seen Honey Dripper, but if you took Silver City, Limbo, what's the other one I'm thinking? Sunshine State. That's
right.
Very true, Jamie.
Right. So I know that we have Kevin Lema at 6:30, and we have a big interview planned with you at 7, but you mentioned Roger Corman, so if we can tackle this before our next interview comes on, and then will you rejoin us at 7?
I will. I'll come back.
Oh, that's great.
Great.
Let's talk about Roger Corman, though, for a second, because it's kind of a precursor to your interview segment a little later in the show, because he is the granddaddy of this whole independent movement, in a way. I mean, just look at the talent that he's kind of fostered and mentored. What are some of his tactics for getting the most bang for his buck, and what were your impressions of him?
Well, the thing you got to remember about Corman is he came into the business as an engineer and not as an artist.
Yeah.
And so he approached it really, really scientifically. And so all the rules that he came up with really had to do with creating a better system for making things run. And also, he's famously cheap. I mean, famously cheap.
That's the name of his autobiography, How I Made Movies Never Lost a Dime.
Exactly. And I think it was Coppola who said, you know, what's wrong with filmmakers today is none of them would be willing to work as long and as cheaply as I did with Roger Corman.
Yeah.
And therefore learn as much as I did because he paid them nothing. But he was really smart about using people. One of the best lessons that I gleaned from looking through Little Shop of Horrors, which is, you know, admittedly not a particularly great film, that's not a great-looking film, is that he had 5 days to shoot that movie. And
that was done in 5 days?
Well, he had 5 days with the cast. He had a cast he paid for from Monday to Friday.
Right.
He spent 3 of those days rehearsing.
Mm.
And 3 of the days shooting. So that gives you an idea of how much value Roger Corman places on rehearsing, that more than half of his budgeted time with the actors was spent rehearsing. So that when they did get in there on those 2 days and everything was shot with 2 cameras, he could get a lot done. And then he did, I think, a weekend or so of pickups after that. But it's
right.
Just 2 days of shooting. That's something that a lot of filmmakers don't think about. They don't, you know, let's show up on the set. Do you know your lines? Yeah, let's shoot it. Now, you contrast that with a filmmaker like Henry Jaglom, who never rehearses. And if you even say the word rehearse to him, you can hear him visibly blanch because he just hates the idea of losing something in a rehearsal that you never get back in front of the camera.
That's evident in his films.
And what was interesting about him, and I've talked to Henry a couple times, and he's just as caustic, I guess would be the word, in
that's
real life.
That's a kind word for him.
Yes, as he appears in the films, is, and he sort of scolded me when I asked him this. I said, do you shoot a scene more than once? And he said, yeah, I'll shoot them a ton of times. I just won't rehearse them. You know, we'll shoot it, and then I'll give some direction. I'll change some thoughts. I'll say, try something else, and we'll shoot him again. So essentially, all Henry's really doing is he's shooting all of his rehearsals.
Right.
But he is still rehearsing. He just would never call it that because he'd hate to lose something that happens in rehearsal he doesn't get on film.
Sure. And there are many different, you know, what astounds me is there's so many similarities in the struggles that independent filmmakers face and when they're dealing with little money and even less time. But they're different approaches too. You know, there's no absolutes really between all of these people that you speak to. And back to Roger Corman, I think his greatest gift has to be recognizing talent. I mean, if you think of his contribution.
Mm-hmm. I think that's true. I also think that if you look at the thousands of people who work for Roger Corman, only a handful are known today. And I would argue that those same people would have made it without him.
Because they had
they
the
all
hunger.
were very, very driven. One example is Amy Jones, who worked for him as an editor and wanted to direct. And she went through his library of scripts of stuff he hadn't shot and found one that had a nice little 5-page scene that had dialogue and it had some action and something else, dialogue action, 3 things in it. Anyway, she spent a weekend, she shot it, and she brought it back to him and showed him that she could direct. And based on that, he hired her, and she went off and made Love Letters for very little money, one of the few movies he made
right.
that ever lost money. But that's just an example of the people who would rise to the top, not just because he gave them a chance, but because they really fought and showed him that they could do it. Coppola was the same way with Dementia 13. He just noticed that Corman had all this equipment and crew in Europe, and Corman had to go back to L.A., and Coppola said, you know, I've got a script, meaning he'd the night before written a script, but he didn't put it that way. And he said there were a bunch of other people on the crew who could have done the same thing, but none of them did. Nobody stepped forward and said, you've got all this equipment, let's make another movie while we're here.
Yeah, and you mentioned that Coppola said that young up-and-coming filmmakers today lack that hunger and drive that kind of defined him when he started in his Corman days. Do you find that that's true?
Oh, I think that's absolutely true. And I think it's, you know, the Sundance mentality is really, in some ways, ruining filmmaking because people aim only for that, and then they don't get that, and then, you know, they're shattered. When you think of all the thousands of movies that never get to Sundance that are actually pretty darn good.
Right.
I mean, there was an article in Movie Maker last month, and it's something they don't do very often. I forget the name of the movie, but it was a long article by the director about why his movie failed and never went anywhere.
Mm.
And I wish there were more articles that talked about the things that don't succeed, because all you read about are the successes.
That's a good point.
And so you get this mindset that everything's going to succeed, therefore it makes sense to put all, you know, the savings in the house into a movie when it really doesn't make any sense to do that.
Yeah, and that can be a definite mind trap, you know,
mm-hmm.
the perception of success, because it doesn't necessarily speak to whether or not your film works, whether you made a good film,
mm-hmm.
or a film that means something to you and is satisfying to you on a personal level. So that's some valuable advice.
About the failures, you assume that all movies that are made are successful.
Yeah.
And that's just not the case.
That's a very good point.
Yeah, that's true. We got a lot of stuff to talk to you about. All the content of these two books, which are fantastic. And so please join us at the top of the hour, and we're very excited to speak to you.
I'll continue our
conversation.
I'll call back in a half hour.
All right,
thank you so
good.
Much,
thank
John.
You.
Take care, guys.
Bye-bye. Thank you for saving us. Bye-bye. That's John Gaspard. We will hear from him again at the top of the hour. I have emailed Mr. Sales Publicist. I have told him that if he wants to be on tonight, then we have his interview all prepared. We're very excited to speak to him. The only open segment we have is for 7:30 Eastern.
Right.
And for those listening to the live feed, if he does call in prior to that time, then
we will go ahead and interview him.
Yeah, but you will have to catch it on the archive.
Right.
Which 95% of our listeners catch our show on the
right,
archive.
That's true.
So that might be a good. So hopefully his publicist is within in some close proximity to his email.
Right.
Receiving. I could call, but at this time, then I'll just hold off on that. Maybe if not tonight, maybe we can do it special Wednesday, the day after Christmas.
Right.
But he is a very important filmmaker, very important figure in the independent film front.
Yeah, I mean, as John was saying, I mean, this man, I mean, this is sort of like, this is the career, and he's right. It is a balance of the commercial and the personal, and he seems to have achieved that. And we're very happy that he's still making movies.
Mm-hmm.
I'm very curious to see, you know, I'm always curious to see what he'll come up with next, because it's never the same thing. He never duplicates himself. Never.
Yeah, and it's
himself.
Been interesting because in researching him and reading previous interviews with him, it's interesting because he has a couple of scripts that are very, very promising, but they're larger scale than he's tackled before as a director. You know, they deal with I think the Philippine War, and they're very kind of grandiose epics in a way.
Yes, they are.
And so he doesn't limit his imagination. And that's another thing I wanted to know from him. If he lets his imagination kind of roam free on that first draft and then considers budgetary concerns and the rewrite process, you know, what his writing process is.
Yeah, I would be very curious to know that. He makes these films, and they are, you know, and I got to say, while they are, I guess, visually they might be restrained as far as, like, locations and things, they are, though, infinite in their ideas and their mm-hmm. imagination, though, and what mm-hmm. you think about, and when they stay with you long after the credits roll up.
Strength of character, too. It's not
He's
so much
a character-driven writer, it seems.
Man, it's not so much that... A lot of times it's in what he doesn't write, but because, especially Honey Dripper, there's a sense of history with these characters, and a lot of it isn't explicitly expressed, but it's there. And I think that something that he does for his actors is he writes character biographies for them.
Yeah, it's not like we're meeting, it's not like when we meet them for the first time, they've all of a sudden appeared. They have
yeah,
a
they've existed
cast.
Prior to and after the film.
Yeah, we just get a couple of minutes into their lives, but he has created something that there's a whole three-dimensional figure there.
You're absolutely
carbon
right.
Copies or cardboard cutouts.
You're absolutely right. I think our next guest might be on the line.
This is like Russian roulette with the phone calls tonight.
I know, isn't it? I believe this is our second guest of the evening. Let's try it. Let's try this, see if it works a little bit better than last time.
Okay.
Okay. Never before has a film's title so perfectly encapsulated the actual viewing experience. Enchanted opened late last month to rave reviews and even more enthusiastic crowd response, becoming one of this year's top successes. And to be sure, the film's seamless blend of charming innocence and sharp, ironic wit will continue to draw eager crowds throughout this holiday season. This is the latest stellar achievement for multi-talented animator, writer, and director Kevin Lehma, whose impressive career includes work in timeless family films like Beauty and the Beast, Oliver and Company, The Little Mermaid, A Goofy Movie, 102 Dalmatians, Tarzan, and Eloise at Christmas Time, for which he won the 2004 Directors Guild of America Award. We are very pleased to welcome to our program this evening Mr. Kevin Lehma. Mr. Lehma, are you with us?
I am.
Oh, terrific.
Right, we got it right. It worked out.
Thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Oh, you're so welcome.
We're very excited to speak to you. We love this film. We love Enchanted.
Oh, that's great to hear.
But first of all, I want to know how influential the Disney films were for you growing up.
Oh, boy, they were my whole life, to be quite honest with you.
Yeah.
From the time I was five, I think I remember seeing Jungle Book with my mom.
Mm.
And she says, although I don't remember this at all, she says I turned to her and said that I was going to draw Disney cartoons when I grew up.
No kidding.
When I was 5 years old, yeah. So I started drawing. I've drawn all my life, and it's sort of the journey I went on.
So what does drawing, what does that do for you? What does it fulfill in you?
Well, it fulfills a lot of different things. One thing it did for me a lot growing up, I didn't have the best of childhoods, I have to admit, and it was a real form of escape.
Yeah.
For me, it allowed me to escape to a world that I could control. In some way, I had total control over that world that I was immersed in.
Mm.
It also happened that I also was pretty strongly into puppetry.
Yeah.
Which is a whole nother, you know, world that you control. So I think that's really what it was for me. It was a way to escape to another place, to a better place in some ways.
Yeah, but were you aware that this was I guess you were aware that this was a career possibility. That
I knew that people did it for a living because my mother bought me some books pretty early on.
Yeah.
And so I was aware that people, you know, that the things were made by people.
Mm-hmm.
So it became more and more sort of as the years went by, of course. I had a high school counselor who art teacher, who hooked me up with the counselor and got me in touch with California Institute of the Arts,
mm.
which is the school I finally went to, which was endorsed by Disney. And, ended up going having a career at Disney for quite a long time.
Oh, that's fantastic. This interests me. The difference between the position of a director in an animated film compared to a live action film, and obviously you have both here with Enchanted.
Right.
But what are the fundamental differences between those two?
Oh boy, the big they're totally different art forms.
Yeah.
One is totally handmade. You know, every single thing that ends up on the screen is handmade. And one of the big differences, and the thing I had to get used to in doing live action, is that everything in live action heads towards a moment in time. You know, there's that moment in time when you shoot the actors in the moment,
mm-hmm.
and you capture it all in that moment. It's not like that in animation. It's so much more fractured, and you have so much more time to contemplate and to redo. You know, if you don't like what you did one week, you just go back whenever you can get the actor again and you redo it the next week. You can reanimate something. No, I wouldn't say quickly, but it can happen, it can happen easily.
Right.
Whereas getting together to do a reshoot on a live-action film is nearly impossible sometimes. So I think the art of animation is really in a sort of an evolving art. It evolves over the 3 years, 4 years, 5 years you take to make it. And live action is very much more compacted. You know, it's much more concentrated.
Yeah.
It happens in a moment in front of the camera.
Sure. Well, speaking of the kind of evolution of animation, you know, your film has 2D animation, which I thought was fantastic. But do you see 2D coming back or kind of coexisting with computer animation?
I sure hope so.
Yeah.
I sure hope so. Disney is, they're working on a couple more 2D animated films.
Great.
So that's all good news. There's one called, I think they've announced it already, called The Princess and the Frog,
mm-hmm.
that they're doing right now. Ron and John, the guys who brought you Little Mermaid and that, they're directing it.
Oh, wow.
So it is happening. I just, you know, I hope the audiences can see that that they're just art forms. They're just different ways to tell a story.
Yeah.
Ultimately,
and,
you know.
What,
one
what
doesn't
that...
have to live at the exclusion of the other.
Exactly. They can, you know, like they can coexist peacefully.
Sure. When oil paints came around, people didn't give up pencils.
Right.
That's true.
You know?
Right.
So there's no reason that one shouldn't, you know, they can't sort of coexist.
And I think that even John Lasseter, who is the Pixar guru, he's been pushing to keep the 2D animation. He has.
He's been a great supporter of it.
Yeah. I understand that the script for Enchanted first came your way about seven or so years ago, didn't it?
Well, actually, what happened was is that I read it in, 2000? And I begged for it. And the studio didn't think I was right for it at the moment. And I read it every year and begged for it again because I thought I knew how to make this movie. And convincing them was kind of hard. They were nervous about the material. Whenever you do something this self-referential,
right?
I think it made them a little bit nervous. And they thought, I think the whole thing started out a little darker than it is right now.
Huh.
And maybe they thought I was a little too, I would give it too light a touch. And finally, after having gone down the road for, I think 5 years before I got involved, and I think the movie had been in development for an extra 4 years before that.
Yeah.
So we're talking about like 10 years of development before I became involved. And, you know, what I did was I did what I know how to do from animation is I actually took a whole floor of the production office and I had some artists working with me and we visualized the entire movie.
Mm-hmm.
A little bit of storyboarding, a little bit of, you know, just illustrations for different sections. And I took the executives on a tour and told them the story of the entire film.
Wow.
And only when they saw that, and it had this whole level of, you know, the parroting Disney, I brought that to the script. So I added that into the whole tour. And, you know, within a half hour of seeing that, Dick Cook saw that tour. And within a half hour, he greenlit the movie.
Mm. So what was to have stuck with it for so long, what was it about the project that spoke to you and made you know in the fiber of your being that you had to do this?
Boy, it just seemed, and it's going to sound odd because there was nothing easy about it, but when I read it, it just seemed easy. I said, I know how to do this. This is something I think I can dedicate myself, and I really thought I was right about the tone. You know?
I said,
I'm going to make this a love letter to Disney.
It is.
It totally is. From, you know, in every fiber of its being, it's a love letter.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's what I tried to convince them of, and I said, this is the movie, this is the way I think the movie should be made. Shrek was already out there. It had already been doing its thing, which is more mean-spirited. But I thought we've got to take the opposite view. We have to take the opposite tact with this. And I'll tell you, from the time that I boarded, I did storyboards for Happy Working Song, I knew that I was right.
You absolutely were. And it's the thing that elevates this film more than anything else. It's a very affectionate kind of ribbing of some of these Disney classics.
Yeah,
it's not mean-spirited
at
all.
Yeah, and I would think that would be the...
I sort of went in thinking, how do I make Mary Poppins for today's audience?
Yeah.
That was kind of my viewpoint. How do I put across this value system that a lot of Disney movies have, you know, for today's audience, which is quite different than it was in the 60s.
Do you find that it's more, if anything, more cynical?
The world or the Disney movies?
The viewing audience, basically.
Yeah, I think they are.
Yeah.
I think they're much more cynical. And they've also seen a lot of media.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we live in a really packed world right now for media.
Saturated, I mean. Yeah.
And it's really difficult to show them something innocent.
But I would think that must have been the hardest balance to find, that kind of the perfect tone that's not too maudlin on one side and not too biting on the other. Was that kind of the greatest challenge?
That was the greatest day-to-day challenge in making this movie.
Yeah.
Is how far do you push it? And I'll tell you, a lot of the times we were on the set trying things, we would try things that were a little bit more mean. And we would just, what I try to do is collect, when I wasn't absolutely sure, collect some variation. so that when I was in the editing room, I had some places to go.
Right.
And there were things. There were things in the movie that were a little bit too mean-spirited that we ended up stripping out. So finding that tone, finding that balance was really the toughest part of it.
Well, I think the humanity and the affectionate tone of the film is kind of epitomized by Amy Adams' performance.
Oh, absolutely.
So she ended up auditioning for the role, and you chose her. Wasn't the studio having hesitation about her? Or?
Well, you know a lot of the story. it's absolutely true. They honestly, they wanted a star to begin with. And I went to them and I said, you know what, I don't want to do it that way. I want the audience to love Giselle for who she is. And I was afraid that bringing in a star and all the baggage that is on top of being a star would somehow infect the character,
mm-hmm.
in a sense. And I wanted the character to be totally believed as a character, sort of like what happened with Daryl Hannah in Splash.
Right, sure. That's a good analogy.
Sure.
That's exactly what I said. I said, I want this. You know, Daryl Hannah had done some movies. People didn't really know who she was, and the same thing happened ultimately with Amy. So I said, let me go, at least go on this journey and prove to you that I'm right. And it's starting to sound like a theme, isn't it, here, that I have to constantly go out and prove that it could work a certain way. And I saw probably about 300 girls.
Yeah.
And it wasn't until, and it was about three-quarters of the way through that number, that Amy Adams walked in the room. I had known of Junebug. I had not seen Junebug, and she had not gotten her nomination yet.
Okay. Yeah, that's what I was wondering, the timing of it, yeah.
No, none of that had happened yet. So I hadn't seen the film. And she walked in the room, and immediately she understood what it was not to make fun of the character.
Yeah.
First of all, she looks like a Disney princess. You know, she walked in, and she has those round eyes and that fair skin.
Sure.
And I thought, please let this be the girl. She looks so great. And she was honestly, the only woman who walked in who understood how not to be embarrassed of the role that she was playing.
Mm-hmm.
And that's ultimately what made it work, you know?
She's 100% invested. I mean,
it was remarkable day in and day out. And from that first audition, she was that way.
Mm.
And so I took a videotape. I was sick as a dog, actually, when I did the interview, the audition. And she made me forget I was sick for 45 minutes, you know, which was great time. I checked that videotape to make sure when I was well. I checked the tape to make sure that I wasn't hallucinating. And I actually brought the tape to Dick Cook again and said, this is the girl I want to play the role. He saw the tape, and there was no denying it. You know, there was no denying that you had someone like Julie Andrews. You know, you were going to make a career here. If it happened properly, you know, if it came together properly, and they went along with it.
And she's magical. She's just magical in the film.
Honestly, the movie would not be the same without her.
I mean, she definitely makes
she
it what
is,
it is.
She is the glue that holds it all together.
But you do have, on the other hand, you do have a fantastic cast all around. You have Patrick Dempsey and Susan Sarandon.
And James Marsden.
He's great.
Who ever thought that he was that funny? And he hadn't done Hairspray at this point. We actually shot our movie before Hairspray shot. So I had no idea that he was the singer or the comedian that he ended up being. And again, he came in and auditioned.
Yep.
And boy, he was like perfect.
He was.
Those performances just soar. But it had to have been exciting to, you know, a big movie like this, something that you've champion for so long, to find yourself shooting it in Times Square. Tell me about shooting in the big city, and particularly the Times Square area.
It was downright frightening to begin with. I had never really shot anything on that kind of level. You know, most of the stuff I had done was all interior stage work.
Yeah.
And the first day of shooting on Enchanted, we were in the middle of Times Square, and she was coming up through that manhole. I got really lucky because I didn't have to necessarily control the crowds, you know, because if the crowds pointed or looked or screamed, that would be a natural reaction to having these characters climb up out through, you know, climb up through a manhole or ride on a bus or do whatever they're doing. So that was really lucky. So that was one big piece of the puzzle I didn't have to deal with. But it's a logistical nightmare, you know, getting that bus back into position to do take two.
Mm.
Is is a lot of work, and right. it's incredibly time-consuming.
Still, that's incredible production value. I mean, that's just...
Oh, yeah, you couldn't ask for anything better. I remember when, in the original script, when I first read it, they fell into Central Park was how they came to the world, and I thought, well, that's not quite eventful enough.
Right.
And I was thinking, what would be the complete opposite of Andalasia, where the animated world? And I thought, Times Square, and then we can use it like Snow White's, you know, journey through the haunted forest, in a sense, is like another reference, when she comes up and she's confronted with all the cars. So so I told my producer, I said, this is where I want to shoot it. This is how I want to rewrite it to be shot in this place. He told me I was crazy. He said, you want to shut down Times Square? That's impossible, Kevin. We went on a couple of, you know, we went on our little recce, our little tour, to scouting tours, to figure out where we were going to do things. And I said, no, this is where I want to do it. I wanted to come out through this manhole. And I went up and I pointed. And luckily, that manhole is not a sewer manhole. It's actually an electricity phone comm, you know,
okay.
kind of manhole. So everything ultimately worked out.
New York works perfectly, too, because you know that when she, in that kind of environment, when she breaks out into song
mm-hmm.
in the middle of the park or the middle of the street, there'll be people that look at her like she's possibly schizophrenic and some people that won't even notice her at all.
Yeah.
Exactly.
It's New York.
That happened all the time we were shooting, too. People would walk right past us and not even look at us.
Yeah.
And we're shooting, or walk right through the middle of our set. they have no idea what we're doing, or they're choosing not to, you know, to look at us or to piss us off, who knows. But it's interesting. An interesting city. And the city's like a big fairy tale town, in a way. It's like an American fairy tale.
Yeah, it's where you go to see if you have what it takes to make your dreams come true.
Yeah. So many people came over here, you know, from different countries and went right through New York City as their entrance into
sure.
their new life.
Something strikes me about your film and the best Disney films in general, and I think it's something that Disney has that most of these other companies that try their hand at similar material don't necessarily have, and it's the appeal to adults and children alike. They're
right.
equally entertaining to both age groups. What is that balance that they've perfected so much? What do you attribute that to?
I don't know. Part of it might be, I know in animation, the people who make those movies are both adults and children at the same time.
Yeah.
I have to say there is still a child inside of me, and that's why I like making these kinds of movies.
Mm-hmm.
So I make the movies for myself, you
right.
know?
Right.
And they end up appealing to both. And I think a lot of people who work like this, like John Lasseter, is definitely that kind of guy. The Pixar folks are all those kinds of people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the best of the people I worked with at Disney Feature Animation are those kind of people, too. It's been hard for the live-action group to grab a hold of that lightning, you know,
mm-hmm.
because they don't necessarily embrace that type of person.
Right.
Within the workforce. So I'm a little bit of a different kind of director for them. They don't necessarily understand me 100%. They don't understand the process
right.
that I go through as an artist. You know, the discovery process of what it is, the visual discovery process. And that's how a lot of the great Disney movies were made, you know. Mary Poppins would have never climbed those stairs of smoke if someone hadn't drawn it first.
Right.
You know, so... Hopefully, that'll change a little bit.
So you have one daughter, correct?
I do. I have
now, has she seen the? Of course, she's seen the film.
Of
with
course,
you.
She's seen it. She's in it.
Oh, she's in it.
Yeah, she's in it. She came out and stayed with me for a month when I was in New York, and I put her to work. Well, she had been complaining, saying she wanted to be an actress at 7 years old, saying you want to be an actress, but she was saying she wanted to do it. So I gave her a little taste of it, and it was hard. It was hard work.
It's actual work.
Yes. That's boring.
It has to be wonderful to watch a work like this with your child and with an audience of children. I'm sure that did you attend some audience screenings of it on opening weekend? And...
Oh, I did. I went in and poked my head into a lot of different circumstances. What I love about this movie, I have to say, is that it seems to affect both kids and adults.
Mm-hmm.
That's true.
I'm, like, so amazed. The one group of people that I thought we were going to have real trouble with, and we are, to a certain amount, getting the adult male into the movie.
Sure.
It's kind of hard. But I am so shocked when they leave the theater And they are actually more enthusiastic about the film than the women are. It's been really odd to watch. And that's been a really great sort of reward of this movie, is that it does affect people. Leave the movie happy.
Yes. And
how many
movies do that for you nowadays?
Not many.
That's so few. So
yeah, that's what I was thinking. I left the theater and I had a genuine smile on my face, and I can't tell you the last time that happened to me watching the movie. It was fantastic. But this a great success for you. Does it kind of, do you feel more pressure for the next time out, or is all the success of this film just gravy?
No, I tell you, I put pressure on myself no matter what.
Right.
What this has done is has opened some doors for me, which is nice. You know, it's given me some opportunities like I've never had before. I can actually go into a studio and people know who I am.
Mm.
You know, they know the movie. And the movie's made a nice impression in Hollywood, you know, with the executives, and that's good to hear. And, there's more openness to make this kind of entertainment.
Now, is this the kind of genre that you feel like you want to dedicate your career to?
I have the itching every once in a while to break out. But I'll tell you, I really like making these kind of movies.
Yeah.
I'd love to do something that would ultimately be Oscar-worthy or,
right.
You know, in some ways what's hard about making movies like this is that the awards groups don't take you as seriously.
And there's no reason for it.
I don't quite understand it because in many ways I think it's a lot harder.
Yeah, there's kind of some sort of snobby kind of sensibility that even if something falls in the comedic range, it's not considered, you know, serious enough to be.
Yeah, I never understood that.
Yeah.
You know, and they couldn't possibly. You're a comedy. They can't give you 5 stars.
That's just
impossible.
It's beyond me. But take comfort in the fact that your film and films that work like your film, they're timeless. I mean, this is a movie that will be passed on to generations, and it will delight each new generation. I really feel that way about
that's
the film.
Very true.
I think you're right. I think it's part of the reason that I stick with it, to be quite honest with you, because I see the effect it has on the audience. And I know from the Disney history that these movies will be around forever.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and there's always a new crop ready to see this kind of entertainment. Mm-hmm. You know, there's always a new audience.
So do you know what's coming up up next for you?
I don't know 100%, no. I've been talking to Disney about doing something based on Little Nemo in Slumberland.
Mm.
Do you know what that is?
Yes.
Yes.
There's a series of comics from the turn of the century.
That's right.
That take place in this whole dreamscape, fantastic dreamscape.
Would this be animated, or would you pursue it more like the live action and animated, or would it be 100% animated?
I'm not 100% sure yet, but I don't think it's going to be fully animated.
Okay.
I think the idea, one of the things I was sort of looking at was it might be fun to do the opposite of what I did here with Enchanted and take a live person and put them into an animated world.
Mm. That would be cool.
So you get that whole turn on things. Now you've got a real person dealing with, you know, the physics and the whole psychology of an animated world.
In a sense,
where anything can happen.
Well, that's fantastic. And whatever you make in the future.
Right now it just sounds a little too hard. And then I go, wow. That's a challenge.
Whatever you make in the future, I will be first in line. And I urge everyone.
Likewise.
If you haven't seen it yet, this holiday season, this Christmas, go out and see.
This
Enchanted.
Is the one to see.
If you're one of the 2 or 3 people out there that haven't seen it, and see it again because if you want to, because it's such a delightful film. And it's just a wonderful film. And we thank you so much, sir, for being on our show tonight. And please come back and join us anytime you'd like to in the future.
You're very, very welcome.
And I will have a happy holiday.
You too. Bye, guys.
Bye-bye now. That's Kevin Lama. He is the director of Enchanted, which, trust me, guys, if I know we have a lot of Kevin Smith fans and some
Well, as a Kevin Smith fan, I went with my mom. We took my niece.
Yeah, I'm not bad talking to Kevin Smith. I'm just saying that they pretty much opposing kind of genres.
I'm sure Kevin Smith loved this film.
Oh yeah, it'll put a smile on a cynic's face.
Yes, it will.
You know, I am that cynic.
You are that cynic. There's no doubt about that. That's why when you told me you loved this, I knew everything would go well. You know, he's right though, and you're right. This film, like Mary Poppins, will like 40 years from now, they'll still be talking about it.
Yeah, and that has to be the highest gratification that you can get from from working on any film, to know that it is going to survive.
Mm-hmm.
Because and as much as a geek as we are about the Oscars, and you know, I personally know that I'm an absolute geek about the Oscars.
I would never have known that.
It's
a big event
every year. It's like more takeout food in my house, and you know, more you know.
A lot of empty Chinese food containers all over the place.
Yeah, you can't talk during the program. You know, it's one of those things. As geeky as I am about that, it's not always the barometer of what movies will survive the test of time.
I'm actually going to go a step further than that. I think sometimes giving a movie the Best Picture Oscar is a sure sign to sometimes, not all the time, but sometimes, assign it to oblivion.
Yeah.
Because, let's say, I mean, there are some recent winners I like, but there are others don't have much of an impact on me.
The way I perceive it is, if you're looking at, if you take the five best picture nominees, whatever they might be year after year,
right,
the best picture should be the one that you stick in a time capsule, so it'll be open hundreds of years from now to represent who we are, you know?
That's a good way to look at it.
As an indication of, you know, who the clearest vision of who we are as a human people.
I can honestly say that there are a lot in the last, not a lot, but some in the last 20 years. I don't think that it works that way.
But shouldn't it be? I mean, doesn't that seem like the barometer?
Should be. This is where it gets very, very tricky, because I don't know. Some of these films, they're not laudatory films. They're not films that, you know, you can go back and watch again and again. They're not films like, let's say, if they're Turner Classic Movies are still around, and 20 years from now we put them on, they might be, you know, you'd be like, this one Best Picture? You mean there was nothing better this year than this? You mean to tell me, you know, it's like, you mean to tell me that this was the best we could do? And that's sometimes, not all the time. There are obviously some films that we love a lot that win Best Picture, and they hold up very well. There are other films you watch that are just like, you mean to tell me the four other movies weren't better than this in the category?
Yeah. By and large, I don't necessarily disagree with Best Pictures more often than not. There's some that are just completely out of line, I think.
So you mean to tell me you don't go back and like watch Shakespeare in Love every year?
You know, that's one that I'd mention, and I hate to say that because there's nothing wrong with Shakespeare in Love.
It was a good movie. It was, but it's not I wouldn't say it's a great film.
And unfortunately, I see Shakespeare in Love. I thought it was a delightful movie, but I see it as the first time that a marketing campaign clearly had an impact.
Well, I'm not going to mention. Let's refer to the gentleman, the name that cannot be named.
Right.
I'm not naming that name on here.
No,
I'm very scared after watching Entourage because Roy Tyken might come over and kick the living shit out of me.
Right.
But,
I'm not talking badly about any filmmakers or any product, but for someone to put Shakespeare in Love up against Saving Private Ryan, and point out which is the more relevant film? What says more about, you know?
You could also say The Thin Red Line too, if you want to go.
Yeah, that was that same year.
Yes.
Yeah.
Even though I want to say this on the record, I want this because these archives do last as long as the internet, I guess, stays up. While they're both about World War II, they're completely
different.
Okay, I just want to say that. Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
And we seem to be because we say that there's no reason why a movie like Enchanted can't get this kind of notoriety. And we seem to be saying by a delightful film like Shakespeare in Love winning over Private Ryan, it sounds like we're negating the point.
I don't think we are, but let me say this though: I think Enchanted is the very definition of a family film. It's everyone in the family will like it, not just the children. It is everyone, whether it's the grandparents, the parents, everyone will like it.
Yeah,
I do think. I'm not talking about, like, people who haven't gone to see it, but I say once you walk into the theater, chances are you're going to like it. This is something that's going to stick with you. I think with Shakespeare in Love, like you said, it's a marvel in marketing and getting the campaign for that film to get where it did and do what it is incredible. I mean, there's a book. I'm sure there has been a book written about
it.
It's a
good film. It's a good film, very well written.
Yeah.
Very, very good performances. Great direction. It's a very nice film.
That's A Year of Life is Beautiful, right? Or no, Life is Beautiful is the following year. Is the following? Okay, I'm sorry.
I think it's the same year.
Because remember, okay, because
he won Best Actor.
Did he get Best Foreign Film that year?
Yes. And that, the talk about a beautiful film. I melt every time I watch that movie.
It's a good movie. He's a very interesting character.
He is.
We should have him on the show.
I don't know if we'd be able to understand anything that happens in the segment, but
it would be. Well, this is why we need.
Pretty
to,
all
this
over
is why
the
we
place.
Need a TV show.
Okay. Our next guest, who we've heard from earlier, he's been so thoughtful to us tonight.
He's been great.
He's been great. Here's his official introduction. Are you guys ready? Here it is.
Yes.
If you're like every other independent filmmaker out there, you're trying to realize your vision with very little money and even less time. So for a jolt of creative inspiration, look no further than John Gaspard's duo of fantastic, fun, and informative books, Fast, Cheap, and Under Control, and Fast, Cheap, and Written That Way. In these two indispensable volumes, Mr. Gaspard collects invaluable insights from indie filmmakers and writers as diverse as George Romero, Robert Rodriguez, Kevin Smith, Dan Futterman, and Eric Bogosian. With exceptionally structured content presented in an easy-to-read, quick and breezy Q&A format, both of these books are must-owns for anyone interested in entering the world of filmmaking. It is a great pleasure to welcome back to our show Mr. John Gaspard. John, are you with us again?
You know, it's so tempting to put on a fake voice and say that I'm John Sayles and just.
I knew you'd want to do that.
Don't do that to us. Voices, I'm sorry.
It's great to hear from you again. It's been a long time.
Yeah, it's been a good half hour.
It was a good half hour. That was very interesting. I have not had a chance to see Enchanted yet because, you know, there's Sweeney Todd and there's Charlie Wilson's War, and then after that there's Enchanted. And you gotta.
Well, you should definitely. You should actually. You know, if you just tonight maybe. Check out Enchanted. Seriously,
you know, I'm calling you from Minneapolis. We got about a foot of snow out there. I'm going to stay home.
Okay, stay home then. Okay, I'm sorry. Don't risk it for you know. Okay.
But you see, now if they had, you know, if I could watch it on TV tonight and pay $9, I'd do that.
That's right. That's right.
That's
that,
a whole other
that,
issue.
That,
yeah.
That might be something
issue.
That.
Yeah.
That might be a distribution tactic that's not too far off in the future. Where
well, they try it.
Well,
yeah.
IFC on our on demand
yeah.
here. IFC has on-demand of the films that they have in the theaters right now.
Right.
So
right.
You could pay $7.99 and watch an independent film right now if it's IFC is the company that put it out.
Yeah.
Great idea.
Yeah.
I think more and more as theatrical dollars kind of suffer in the home entertainment market is just blossoming, you know,
mm-hmm.
more and more. I think that's going to be a possibility. But, John, tell me about your history in film. I know that you've directed or produced 6 low-budget films yourself, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've been making film since I was about 13 years old. I made one of the first Super 8 sound feature films ever made in the world, and I don't recommend it. and I've shot on, we shot back in the 80s on the old U-Matic video cassettes. Remember those big clunky things?
Yeah.
Oh, I remember those, yeah.
So that was like the first video, but it wasn't digital at that point. Then I've shot a couple features on 16mm, and the last one was done fully digital.
So all of these experiences that you've had, there had to have been some perils or stumbling blocks that you ran into, and you must have thought to yourself, I wish I had, you know, someone, an expert here with me that has these answers. Is that
mm-hmm.
the impetus of why you started these books?
Well, sort of. My producing partner, Dale Newton, and I made 2 movies in the 90s on 16mm, one called Resident Alien,
uh-huh.
which is a sci-fi comedy, and one called Beyond Bob, which was a romantic comedy ghost story.
Yeah.
And we got done with both of them and realized that we'd learned, you know, as much as you're ever going to learn in a film school, doing both movies and being the type of people we are, which is very, what's the polite word, very anal, we took a bunch of notes as to what we'd learned because we knew we were going to forget about it. And I said, you know, we have a book here. And he said, really? And I said, well, maybe. And so I did a little tiny bit of research to see what kind of books were out there and sent off 2 letters to 2 publishers and never got a response from one of them. And the other one called me up and said, it's a great idea for a book. Why don't you guys write it? So we ended up writing down everything we knew about filmmaking, which then became the book Digital Filmmaking 101.
Yeah.
And when that was done, the publisher called and said, do you have anything else you want to do? And when I was younger and starting out, there were some books that I read that I really, really liked and keep going back to because they had really good lessons in them, like Filmmaker Superstar was one, and a film called Breaking Through, Selling Out, Dropping Dead, and Other Notes in Filmmaking. And they had just really good lessons. And I said, you know, it would be great if someone assembled all the smart stuff people have said about how to do a low-budget movie. And he said, sure, go ahead and do that. So that became Fast, Cheap, and Under Control. And it started out as being just me kind of culling existing interviews and pulling just the best stuff out and putting them together under the headings of lessons. And then I found out that I could actually talk to people. People would return my calls.
Yeah.
So I didn't have to do all that culling. So about half the book is interviews with people, and the other half is sort of culled stuff. And when I was done with that, the publisher said, do you want to do another book? And I said, well, I've sort of done that, but one of the things I've noticed is that people really seem to gloss over the screenwriting process in low-budget filmmaking. They seem to say, well, I'm going to write a script in a couple days, and then I'm going to go out and shoot it. And then you hear about how they raised money and how they shot it and how the post and all that, but they never really talk about what it took to actually write the script. And I also thought, having done the previous book and having trouble getting a hold of directors and no trouble getting a hold of writers, I thought, well, the writers will talk because writers like to talk. So we did the second book, which is Fast, Cheap, and Written That Way, which is all just interviews I did with writers who had started out in low-budget films. And I sort of fudged low-budget from anywhere from, you know, $30,000 up to $2.5 million or so.
Okay. So that's part of what I was interested in, what your criteria was when you were seeking out these filmmakers. What kind of boundary?
Well, part of the criteria was, will they return my call?
That's always
which
important.
Which is true. I mean, there's tons of people I would have liked to have talked to. I would have loved to have talked to Kevin Smith and had literally 2 years of emails with his assistant saying, maybe next week.
Right.
And never got that, although his stuff is pretty well documented, so he didn't need to talk to him.
Well, he documents it himself.
Yeah.
To an excessive degree.
Yeah, I mean.
The criteria was, I wanted to not keep doing kind of the same movie over and over, so I tried to find people who'd done really different movies. So it goes from Capote, which is probably our highest budget film, which is probably actually closer to $5 million now that I think about it, down to someone like Bob Clark, the late Bob Clark, who had done a terrible little zombie film called Children Shouldn't Play with Dead Things.
Exactly.
Those films,
a great title.
He's a hero to a lot of our listeners.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
And he even was surprised up to the end about how popular the film was. It's not a great little film, but one of the things he talks about is it's a great title.
Yes.
And that's one of the things that really got him launched in that script was having a really good title, which is something Amy Jones, who did Love Letters and Slumber Party Massacre, said, you know, you got to have a good title. You don't want a movie, what did she say? You don't want a movie called Dust and Dirt. She was running into a lot of those sorts of things at film festivals. She said, have something provocative and interesting, and because that's the first thing people are going to hear about.
Yeah, yeah. That reminds me of the parody of the Oscars and those Naked Gun films, and they were announcing some of those terrible
titles. That's classic.
Sawdust and Mildew. Or something similar to that. But did you find it that most everyone was very eager to participate and share their lessons that they've learned?
The ones who said yes did it because they really wanted to. I remember Kenneth Lonergan, who did You Can Count on Me.
Yeah. Oh, that must be cool.
He was so adamant about wanting to do this, and it took a lot of time to get his schedule and my schedule to come together. Rebecca Miller, who did Personal Velocity, who was living in Ireland at the time.
That's a great film.
Yeah. She was terrific about, there was like a 6-hour time difference between us, and just trying to figure out a time in her day in Ireland raising kids that would be a good time to call, which as it turned out was nap time, which was 4 a.m. here. So it's kind of nap time at both ends, actually.
Right.
But yeah, they were really, really, Dan Futterman was the same way. You know, there's stuff that he really wanted to get on the record, and that nobody was asking him about. So.
Yeah, it's interesting that you spoke of Rebecca Miller, and I was fascinated by something that she said when she's talking about writing for a low-budget film. She said, you know, you kind of get bogged down by all these subplots and too many characters, and I think she said something like, when you peel the fingernail off the giant, a lot of times you realize that the story is in that fingernail.
Yep. Yeah, keep it small. Just look at the detail and try to follow up on that.
Yeah.
Which is sort of reflected in something Joan Milken Silver said, which is more of a production issue, but I left it in because it was would affect screenwriting, which was when she did Hester Street, she was trying to recreate Ellis Island and couldn't afford to recreate the way she wanted to, and so she had to reduce it down to the single most important element. And in her mind, that was it was a chain link fence between the people who were trying to get in and the people who are already here. And so that's what the scene is. It's about the fence, and it isn't about trying to recreate this huge room with all these teeming masses of extras in perfect period clothing, because she couldn't do that. So she was able to reduce it down to the essential idea, which and then drove her crazy when she could see Godfather Part II, when Coppola had all the money in the world and did that big shot with all the extras and all
Right.
But that's low-budget filmmaking.
Is the low-budget independent film, is it getting harder to define nowadays in terms of what an independent film is?
Well, I think it's always been hard to define what independent is because everybody shares one thing, which is a need to get in front of an audience.
Mm-hmm.
And that's true of any artistic endeavor. The hardest part is the last part, distribution.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're independent up until that point, and then you're either dependent or nobody ever sees you.
Right.
Yeah. So it's I think because there's more people making more movies because it's easier and cheaper to do it, it's feeling like independent cinema is different now. But I don't think it really is that different because distribution is still the biggest.
That's the holy grail.
It really is. I mean, I know they say people can, you know, you can watch Edward Burns' new movie on iTunes if you want.
Yeah.
But
oh, that's right. That's right.
Most people don't want to sit in front of the computer and watch movies. I mean, there's the geeks of us who will. But
after a while, it is refreshing to go to the theater to see.
Yeah, we're never going to lose that. And as long as, you know, the big companies are in control of what goes into the theaters, and the theaters are beholden to them because they're not going to get the next big movie unless they run this one,
mm-hmm.
it's going to be really hard for small films to be seen in front of big audiences.
Yeah. I want to talk about a couple of the concepts that you discuss in both of these books. In the first book, Fast, Cheap, and Under Control, when it comes to having more control on your production, they say that less money actually can benefit you. I've heard it spoken several times in the book that the less money you have, the more control you have.
Yeah, I think that's true.
How does that work? Explain that to me.
Well, I'll just use a personal example because I made a movie a couple years ago, a digital film called Grown Men, for approximately $11,000 to $13,000. It was somewhere in there.
Mm.
And I had a friend at the time who raised money and made a movie for about $150,000. And they were both done at about the same time. Now, the pressure on him to take almost any deal that would come along in order to get that movie out was much greater than the pressure on me because I didn't have anybody except me and you know, my wife looking at me going, where's the money? But I didn't have investors saying, where's my $50,000?
Mm-hmm.
So you have a huge level, greater level of control if it's less money. And that's, of course, at the distribution end. During the shooting end, you actually have more control, too, because there's nobody breathing down your neck saying, this is costing money to do this every day. You know, a regular movie costs thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars a day to shoot. If you're just running out with your friends in a little digital cam and you got a light kit and some actors, it's not going to cost you that much if you spend another hour on something.
It also forces you to make more creative choices, too, when you can't throw money at a problem.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Robert Rodriguez calls it the money hose.
Yeah.
If you don't have the money hose, you got to come up with something else.
Yeah. And a lot of times those creative solutions are infinitely more interesting and serve the film a lot better than
mm-hmm.
the alternative.
Almost always.
Yeah. And a few of the points of how to write for lower-budget films, I know it's emphasized several times, fewer characters and fewer locations. I guess the real struggle is how to not let the struggles of working within a limited budget limit your imagination when you're writing.
Right. That's something I asked, I think, just about all of them, and I think they're split kind of 50-50. Some of them, and this is, I think, 23 writers in that book, some of them were very conscious throughout of you know, any time they wrote something, the impact it was going to have on the budget. And then some, like Casey Lemons or Ali Salim, who did Sweetland, didn't give it a second thought. In fact, in Ali Salim's case, he wrote the script and then rewrote it and had people do readings, and really was not concerned about the budget until when he was ready to make it, at which point a producer sat down with him and said, okay, scene inside a train, can't do that, make the scene inside of a train station because we can't afford a moving train. And the little things like that he was able to make the adjustments, save tons of money, but he hadn't let that worry him as he was writing it. So, I mean, and that worked for him. For some people, you got to have the, you know, how many sets do I have? Okay, I'll write to that many sets.
Yeah.
If you look at, I think it's Bill Martell's site on script writing, and he's done about 20 cable films. He's just brilliant about breaking it down and going, okay, I've got X number of pages, therefore I can have X number of sets, therefore if I'm writing 5 pages on that set here, I've got to come back to that set for 7 more pages at some point.
Mm-hmm.
You can take that approach too. That's the problem with filmmaking is with a lot of things. There's no absolute right or absolute wrong answer. There's just whatever works.
Right.
But what are some of the common mistakes though when people are trying to write within a limited budget?
Well, they'll forget that, you know, inside the house is a move from outside the house. They'll forget that, you know, if you've got a house and you write scenes for 7 rooms, you've got to move the cameras and everybody 7 times. If they'll think of it as one location.
Right.
It isn't. They'll think of night and day as being just as cheap to shoot, and day is very cheap to shoot, and night, depending on what you're trying to shoot, can be very expensive if you're outside. But it's stuff that if budget isn't an issue like it is in most movies, you would never even think of it. It's like, you know, if you're going to do a big gunfire scene, it's much easier to have glass blown out than to have bullets hitting brick walls, because you got to plant all the squibs and blow them all up.
Right.
But all you got to do is replace a piece of glass if that's what you're doing.
Right. With these interviews with all these filmmakers, do you get a sense that they prefer to work in the low-budget field because it kind of brings out the best of what they have to offer?
I think they like the independence that comes with low-budget, because they are, you know, first and foremost writers.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But that being said, I think, you know, they're willing to do what's necessary to get their movie made, and if that means that they've got to rewrite something for a budgetary reason, they're wise enough to know, I mean, that you have to sometimes give up things because that's the realm you want to work in.
Yeah. Now, the publisher, it's Michael Wise Publications that has published these 3 of your books. We've interviewed several of their authors, and they're a great company,
They're great guys.
Yeah, great company. And we've been infinitely impressed by their line of books. But you say that every time out they offer you another book, you know, what else do you have now? Have they come back to you, or what are your future plans?
Well, you know, it's funny. He just did email me this week. He lives in England now. And I don't know if you know Michael. He was the guy who produced the first Star Wars parody.
Hardware Wars.
Oh, that's right.
Which
is a very funny movie. In fact, he redid it recently as the new digital version. So he goes way back when it comes to independent filmmaking. And he did email me this week with an idea for another low-budget book. But I'm starting to work on a novel now, actually finishing a novel, and need to work on that. And also probably should get back to actual filmmaking, because that's been a couple years.
Right.
You know, listening to other people talk about it, which is fun for a while, but
it gets the itch going again.
Doesn't do something
it?
Else, yeah.
Yeah, but how rewarding is the process of writing these books? And I know you say that you're working on a novel. Is it a different kind of reward writing these types of books compared to a novel?
It's entirely different. What's really fun, and I think I've actually said it in one of the books, really only the reason that I did the writer book was I wanted to talk to these people.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that you guys got to read what I heard was kind of incidental. I mean, that was the fun part.
Where, yeah.
You know, sitting on the phone listening to Kenny Lonerman talk, or Dan Futterman, who was terrific, Stuart Gordon, who did Reanimator, who is one of the nicest guys in the world, and is you know, so smart about drama because he's part of the Organic Theater in Chicago, and he brings all that theatrical stuff with him, which other people don't. That was fun. Then you got to type it and edit it, and that's not really fun. And then you get to hear from other filmmakers who've read it and who have their own points of view on it. That's the fun part. Once it gets out, then you start getting emails and stuff, and that's fun again.
So it's a real tidal wave. It's a real wave.
It's a real up and down kind of
thing. Up and down. So novel writing. Have you written a novel previously?
I never have, and I didn't intend to do one now, but I had an idea for a movie and started doing notes on it and realized pretty quickly that the stuff I was writing wouldn't work in a screenplay, that it was too interior, too much of the character's thoughts, and before I knew it, it was a novel. So.
Wow.
Wow, that's a very much like John Sayles kind of path.
Kind of going the other way, yeah. He started as...
But that's true, but I see that in his films, too, in that they have kind of... Some of them have they feel like novels on film. I felt that way about Zodiac earlier this year, where it played like a great novel.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, he's a very literary writer. That's pretty clear in his work.
Yeah. The books are called Fast, Cheap, and Under Control, and Fast, Cheap, and Written That Way, and they're available through Michael Wise Publications, and they're fantastic books, and they're must-owns. And Mr. Gaspard, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, guys. It was fun.
For saving us the first segment and for coming back to us now.
Well, you've got my number if you ever run into
it. Yeah, we'll call you.
Just give me a call.
If a guest doesn't show if
I'll be your standby guest.
Thank you so much.
Thank
we appreciate you very much.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye now. That is John Gaspard, terrific author and writing a new novel. That's great. And his books are fantastic. They're very very breezy. I went through them just like that. I was just devouring everything I could get from them.
Well, they sound very informative, and it sounds like he learned a lot and got a lot of different stories from each of these filmmakers and writers.
That's just
struggles.
It, man. You know, because you could easily write a book. You could easily write a book just about the horror movie genre, because that's how so many people are breaking into independent films nowadays. They're making horror movies and that kind of thing. You could fill a book with those stories. But it really encapsulates kind of the versatile nature of people are making movies about all sorts of genres and all sorts of topics and themes, and
they're doing
it the same way. You know, they're facing the same struggle no matter what the content is.
Very true.
And you know, there's great artists that that choose to work that way still. You know, and because it brings out the best in their art.
Very true.
Yeah, so it's been a great show. Should we talk about what's coming out Christmas Day? Juno, I think, has a wide release Christmas Day.
Okay, yeah, no, Juno was, yeah, we talked about that last week, but Juno, I guess it goes wider. It goes wider on Christmas Day. We got The Great Debaters with Denzel Washington.
Yes.
And The Water Horse, who we interviewed the director a couple of weeks
Jay
ago.
Jay Russell, yes.
And we have Alien vs. Predator, Requiem, a great Christmas Day film. I couldn't think of a better film for the Yuletide season. I'm looking forward to that, but everyone knows that already. But
a double bill, Enchanted and Alien vs. Predator.
But I think we need to talk about what comes out December 26th.
December 26th.
Yeah, There Will Be Blood, which I don't think we get until next year.
Is that a New York, L.A. opening?
New York, L.A. They're the only ones getting it, I think, and maybe another city, but... You know, that's where all the anticipation is with that film.
However, there is a midnight. I believe there is a midnight show. I'm sorry. You know, I just realized I have the TV on, and my beloved Buccaneers are losing San Francisco.
I don't have my TV on. I was willing to make that sacrifice.
volume's down. I just took a look over to, and I can't believe what I'm saying. Okay, I'll try to sound upbeat. There are midnight shows that
I've heard about this.
The 29th, in about maybe 25, 30 cities across America.
Okay, well, we'll have to investigate that.
Yes, and we're trying to get talent from that film. And actually, next month should be fantastic. We will be joining you again on Sunday the 30th, and we're still discussing what to cover. Maybe a year-end wrap-up, since that's our last show of the year.
Yeah, I mean, that we could do that, but in case John Sayles might also... You know, that might happen too.
Wouldn't that be great? What's going on with guest segments kind of being?
No, but we've been. I have to tell you, we've been doing very well.
Come back tonight, but absolutely. But, yeah, and we have some Sundance Sundance series scheduled for next month.
And a very interesting lineup this year at Sundance, so that will be very exciting talking about that.
Correspondence, yeah, correspondence with a lot of those talents that whose films are in competition this year at Sundance, including one that I'm very interested in. It's a Michael Keaton.
That's right, yes. That's the one he's directing, right?
Directing and starring.
Okay.
Yeah. With Kelly McDonald, the female lead in No Country for Old Men.
Yes. Oh, she's a great actress.
Yeah, she's really come into a special place now. Where, yeah, she's coming into her own. The opportunities are there. It's all about opportunities, too, man. We're talking about this earlier. We're talking about this, I think, last night when we discussed Charlie Wilson's War.
Right.
Where you get a sense of Tom Hanks in this movie. It kind of recalls his rascally earlier performances.
It does. It is like Bachelor Party or Volunteers or Dragnet.
Yeah, it has that kind of feel to it. But, you know, we loved Tom Hanks. We always did. But you had no way of predicting this is future two-time Oscar winner Tom Hanks.
I would never have guessed that.
It's just about opportunity when the opportunity comes.
Yes, it is.
Seems like Kelly MacDonald, this is her time. And Amy Adams.
Amy Adams, and also I have to say, you know, maybe it's Josh Brolin's time. He's had a great year.
I don't like the fact either, Jamie, as I think New England has San Francisco.
Yeah, I saw that. I didn't know what to make of that.
Welcome to Football Geeks United.
I saw that. I think I let that slide, you know.
It's Football Sunday. I mean, what can we do? Do you watch football at all? Do you follow it?
I the Redskins, and that's so I'm waiting to see what happens tonight.
So you don't really follow it?
Outside of the Redskins, no.
Yeah, that's what I was getting at.
I follow it more than people think, though.
All right, let's tie these in. Football movies. Any decent football movies?
Oh,
I'm trying
North
to fill
Dallas
the time.
40,
I'm trying to fill
North
the time
Dallas
until,
40, semi-tough.
I'm trying to fill the time until
and 7:30. The Longest Yard, the original Longest Yard.
Okay. Definitely not the remake.
No. It is too much. That's the second remake. There's a British remake of that movie, too.
Oh, is it?
Jason Statham and Vinnie Jones.
So Any Given Sunday is just a dismissal?
No, I like Any Given Sunday, but I think those films, like Semi-Tough and North Dallas 40 and especially The Longest Yard, those are some of the best.
Yeah.
I guess Black Sunday, the one with, if you want to count that as a football movie. And cool. We'll have to see about this George Clooney movie when it finally comes out.
Leatherheads, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it comes
no,
out.
No, I like, I know a lot of people don't like Any Given Sunday. I enjoy Any Given Sunday. And Rudy, as Anthony Thurber brought out, Rudy is an excellent film.
Yeah. Yeah. I
what think about Radio, Anthony?
Radio. Yeah, we're trying to monitor the chat. You know, it's over. The game's over. The Bucks lost. I don't know if I can go on.
I really, we had to end the show on a down note.
We hate to do that. But we wish everyone out there a great holiday season.
Yeah, happy holidays to everyone.
Yeah, absolutely. We'll be back with you next Sunday. If you want to get your geek on prior to next Sunday, we know a week absence can be very strenuous and draining. So you can go back through our archives and find our great interviews with past guests like Brian De Palma, actor Raymond J. Barry, one of the most rewarding interview segments.
Yeah, he was great. That was a wonderful interview.
Yeah. I think there's just fantastic material in our archives. So please go back through that Big Lebowski tribute, Blair Witch Project reunion, and we're going to be doing more of that reunion stuff too. We're going to
doing more of the reunion stuff and more of just making. Hopefully, we'll do another just a show devoted to one film.
Yes.
In the future.
Yeah. So great stuff coming up on Movie Geeks United. We will reschedule with Mr. Sales. We're sure it's just an oversight, and this Sunday and you know the weekend kind of comes along and distracts you, and especially when this is reconfirmed on a Friday, it can.
Right.
Yeah, we understand. So we will reschedule with Mr. Sales, and we should have no problem doing so. And join us again next week.
All right.
And happy holidays, everyone.
Happy holidays, everyone.
Thanks
Thank
for
you.
Joining us. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.